by the technology here. My name's John Nichols. I'll be the chair for the session here this afternoon, session 3F, which will be about derivatives for retail investment products. Presenting the session, we have Zach Roberts and Matthias Soderberg. So just a quick introduction, then we'll hand over to Zach and Matthias. After surviving 5 years at the mercy of the Japanese education system, I can't imagine what that's like, Zach worked as a consultant.
We're going to touch very briefly on those, but then also, you know, we're looking at what's the actual purpose of those type of products, and to my way of thinking, it's to provide investors with a different risk and return profile than they can get just from traditional asset classes. Okay, so one way of doing that is for the product provider to accumulate those asset classes and then provide guarantees. We'll look at an alternative, which is where, you know, from the product provider's point of view, the asset class itself has the guarantee inputted. Yes, there is someone providing the guarantee, but it's not the product provider, so therefore it doesn't have the same investment risk, etc., of considerations that the product provider has to go through. So I'm going to sort of talk about the first half, and then Matthias can sort of give some examples of the second part. Here's just sort of a high-level comparison of the two different ways of providing investors with that different risk and return profile. The one I have there on the left is where the product provider or insurance company provides the guarantee and hedges it themselves, and therefore the use of derivatives in that point is in hedging the guarantee that's already been provided. Whereas on the right-hand side, I'm looking more at using derivatives to manufacture the returns provided by the asset. I won't go through all those comparisons up there, but I suppose it's worth pointing out that from the product manufacturer's point of view, that's where the biggest difference is really. From the investor's point of view, it's basically the same thing. You know, there can be differences in, you know, what type of underlying assets or investments are fit better under either approach, but the big difference is the product manufacturer. You know, are you liable to the ongoing management of the investment risk, or, you know, have you passed that on to someone else? This is my simple version of what risks manufacturers are taking on when they are writing guarantees. I put it into sort of three risks. The first being balance sheet risk, which is, from my way of thinking, that's the risk that when it comes to pay out a guarantee, you don't have the money to do it. So however you've chosen to manage the risk, it just hasn't been adequate. So therefore, you've got to dig your hands in your pockets and pay out the guarantee. That's what I call the balance sheet risk. I distinguish that from the profit volatility risk. And the profit volatility risk, you know, you might have a great risk management strategy in place, which means that at the end of the product, you don't have to put your hand in your pocket. You know, it's all covered, no balance sheet risk. But over time, it might have cost you twice as much as you expected. So therefore, your month-on-month profits or year-on-year profits, because the way these products are designed, you're normally receiving a regular income stream from the policyholder to cover the investment risk. But the cost of implementing your investment risk strategies could vary up and down considerably with markets. So it's that sort of period-on-period sort of actual versus expected profit risk, which I call the profit volatility risk. Then there's a decrement risk, which I'm not going to go into this presentation, but, you know, it's definitely worth remembering with these type of products that, you know, you don't want to incentivize policyholders to behave in a way which, you know, is not really in your interests. This is the continuum of managing investment risks. If we look far over on the left side, you know, we've got insurers taking market risks or bets and not hedging. You know, you could call that the early 1980s investment account market, I suppose. All the way through to the right-hand side, where the insurer is basically just either completely reinsuring or completely passing on to someone else the investment risks, and they're really just, you know, either white labelling someone else's product or backing out the investment risk from the product. In between, there's various degrees of internal hedging, ranging from either, you know, dynamic hedging purely with futures to manage directional exposure. That is, I remember, I think it was Wade Madison at this thing 2 years ago, had a survey of US companies, and over half of companies that sold guarantees that did dynamic hedging only hedged delta risk. Okay, I'm sure some of those are wishing now they maybe hedged a little more. But that's sort of the simple end of the spectrum. Moving a little more along, you're looking at hedging sort of other risks. So you're looking at delta, maybe interest rates and volatility as well. And then you can get all the way towards the right-hand end of the spectrum, where you're hedging a lot more, including sort of correlation and future volatility and those type of risks. It's probably a misnomer that we've called that static hedging, because it's definitely far more dynamic than the others. I've just chosen the label static because in our experience, from the insurance company or product provider's point of view, they don't generally do that themselves. That's what they buy from someone else. So from their point of view, it's buy and forget, and it's static from their point of view. Definitely not static from whoever they bought it from. Okay. I thought we'd put in some actual numbers to try and raise a bit of interest, make it interesting. What we've done here is had a look at a quite simple 10-year savings product with inbuilt guarantees. So at the end of the 10 years, you get back either the account balance or the greater of the guarantee. We've looked at two different types of guarantees. One there is the annual ratchet, which is your guarantee starts off at your single premium level, and every year, if the fund is bigger, that becomes your new guarantee. Add on until you get to the end of 10 years. The other one we've looked at is accumulation, where it's just simple, regardless of the performance of the fund, you're guaranteed at the end of the 10 years to receive your initial premium accumulated at a certain rate, or the maximum of the fund, whatever that is. Looked at two different asset mixes there, sort of the first one being 50% equities, 50% bonds, and the other one 40% equities and bonds, and 20% in alternative assets. Okay. And that's where we've come up with as external guarantees, or using the terminology from the previous page, how much it would cost to implement a static hedge. I might ask questions. Does anyone think that's expensive, cheap, or doesn't understand it and wants me to explain further?
Could I just ask about the alternatives, given that alternatives are obviously not priced on the market? How have you priced an option on it?
That's a particular basket of alternative assets where all the underlyings have daily liquidity and do have active markets. No, we're talking about sort of currency, commodity plays, long short equity, things like that, where the underlying markets do have daily liquidity. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to note that it does decrease the cost. I mean, you would expect it to from diversification benefits. Yeah, and it's unfortunate. I mean, I'll say up front, I'm going to sort of mention Axis product a bit. I don't necessarily want to pick on it or promote it. It's just the only one around at the moment. But I think John mentioned in his session earlier this morning, they have 100 funds if you want to go that product without a guarantee, 40 if you want the guarantee, and 4 that don't make it are their alternative ones. Because, presumably because it's harder for them to internally dynamically hedge those 4 funds. Whereas, there would be benefits in including those. Yep. It's hard to get numbers out of traders if it's not for actual trade.
Okay.
So I thought, you know, enough in there to get the gist. And then, you know, yeah, there's no reason to think they wouldn't sort of just be linearly approximations from the others. Yeah. The reason we chose 3.5, incidentally, is because a couple of months ago when this pricing was done, that was the price of an inflation swap. So therefore, instead of a 3.5 accumulation, you could actually guarantee to increase at least at inflation. Okay, that would be about 4% these days, not 3.5, so slightly more expensive. But you know, it's, if you're talking about retirement and long-term products, it's maybe a good feature to have. Okay. Well, I'll move on then and say, do we think it's expensive or not? Unfortunately, we couldn't compare like with like here, but we have AXA's 10-year product, investment strategy one, which is the sort of least aggressive of the three investment strategies. You're only allowed, I think, up to 60% in equities and property. And they have a guaranteed charge of 1.25%. We priced a similar design. It's not exactly the same. It's a little, I suppose, the design we priced is a little more expensive, but then we had a slightly less sort of percentage of growth. We only had up to 50%. So, you know, sort of give on a bit on one side and take a bit on the other. The price came back at 1.8. As we saw, if you included alternative assets, it would, you know, it would be a bit cheaper, but it is more expensive. And I think there's three reasons why it generally comes across as being more expensive. The first, because, well, the first thing to note, I suppose, there's two reasons and one thing to note, is that the strategies we're talking about here are all based on, you know, index sort of replication, you know, ASX 200 type futures. So on top of that 1.8%, there's no investment management fee. Whereas on top of the AXA's one, you get to choose your funds and there is their external investment management fee. Okay. But that aside, the two things that sort of make the 1.8% more than 1.25, in my opinion, are that the 1.8 you're pricing based on implied volatility, and sort of we'll explain more what I mean by that, and that you're actually paying the cost to hedge all the risks. And again, we'll explain what I mean by those. Okay. Pricing on implied volatility. Generally, when an insurer prices these type of guarantees, they'll look at long-term costs and market averages, and they'll say, okay, if I did such and such a dynamic hedging strategy, over time, how much do I expect it to cost me? Okay, and that will be based, that's basically pricing based on their expectation of future realised volatility. It's based on how much they expect it to cost them going forward. If you go to an external provider of the guarantee, they're going to price you based on how much it costs in the market to protect that guarantee. And that'll be based on today's implied volatility. You know, the reason insurance companies offer these at a lower price is that they're willing to put sort of their own balance sheet at risk. And then over time, hope, and based on historical data, quite a reasonable hope, that the actual price will be cheaper than the price would be on realised volatility. There's an interesting little thing you can do if that is an issue. If you're saying, look, I don't want the balance sheet risk that comes with providing a guarantee. You know, I don't really want to have to manage that, but I don't want to pay out this implied volatility. You know? I'm happy to just pay sort of based on realised volatility, and I'm happy to wear the profit volatility period on period because that'll go up and down. As opposed, I know for an implied one, I know the cost up front. I'm happy to bear it up and down because on average it should be smaller. What you can then do is this type of structure here where instead of paying for protection up front, you pay for it in arrears based on the realised volatility over each period. Okay, so as an example here, what we've just shown is the flat line going across is the price of a 90% put option, a one-year 90% put option on the ASX 200. So you're looking at about 1.4% per quarter, so what's that, a bit on about 5.5% per year. using that type of formula, which instead of paying a fixed amount, you pay a variable amount, which is sensitive to the level of actual volatility, you can construct it so that at a certain point, any volatility above that certain point, it will cost you more than just buying the upfront option. Any volatility below, it will cost you less. To give you an idea, sort of the crossover point there is around about 24%. At the time, implied volatility in the market was about 25%, I think. 25. So, whereas, you know, a few months earlier it had been 16%, and a lot of people predict that in sort of 6 months, a year's time, it'll be 15, 16%. So, as a long-term bet, you might say, I'm not happy paying 25% up front because I think over the long term it's going to be a lot lower. So instead, yes, I want that type of protection, but I only want to pay an amount that's linked to actual volatility. So that's just one way of, if you think of this as the reason I split the risk into those two types, sort of balance sheet risk and profit volatility risk. That's one way of removing the balance sheet risk but keeping the profit volatility risk. And why would you do that? You would do that because you expect it to cost you less. It may cost you more, and that's the risk you take. That's the profit volatility risk. It may cost you more. You expect it to cost you less. And sort of theoretically, you expect it to cost you about the same as a dynamic hedging strategy would end up costing you, just without, you know, all the hassles of actually setting one up. The other reason I talked about external guarantees being more expensive is hedging all the risks. I've already alluded to the fact that, you know, as of a few years ago anyway, over half of the US insurers offering these guarantees only hedge the delta. So it's time for another question. Let's say you wrote a portfolio of this business and you were managing the risk internally and you had to choose how far down the hedging spectrum you're going to go in actually, you know, hedging the risk versus how much you're willing to keep on your balance sheet. How much do you think in terms of a loss in 1 month is acceptable in sort of an extreme event? So what I mean by that is, if you've got, you know your expected monthly profit, as a multiple of that, how much would you be willing to lose in 1 month in an extreme event? That's not a rhetorical question. You can take it. Who says no more than, say, 6 months? Aggressive people. No more than 1 year? Yeah, no more than 1 year. 1.5 years? 2 years? 5 years? No idea. just a bit of context. I've heard that there is one writer of this type of business globally who, in one of their locations, in one of the months in, you know, sort of the recent history, through market volatility, they had an internal dynamic hedging system in place, managed to lose 2.5 years of expected profits in 1 month, due just to sort of hedge slippage between how the liabilities moved and how the hedge assets moved. So it's, you know, it's important to think, yeah, okay, it's okay to not to hedge all the risks, but it's important to understand them and understand what you're choosing not to hedge. I might hand over to Matthias there.
Your favourite slide on the green side there.
Yeah. You're from Western there.
Yeah, I don't know how much of these type of risks that we need to sort of go through line by line. It probably quite quickly becomes quite boring. I guess Zach's particular his view is, I guess, that along the investment sort of hedging continuum that he described, each and every institution will have an optimal point where you want to be, whether that is one of the extremes or in the middle. But I think the point is that that needs to be an active choice and not just something where you end up by, because of what's been done in the past or what sort of everyone else is doing. Another way to look at derivatives is, like Zach said, is basically to look at to manufactured returns instead of hedging returns. Now, obviously, that's somewhat complementary, but can also be a completely different approach to using derivatives. So, keep it not necessarily as a natural progression of this, but depends, I guess, on the institution. For some people, it's might be most beneficial to adopt one or the other of the two approaches, and for others there might be actually sort of overlapping opportunities. But I guess we wanted to include this section because it's been just such a dramatic growth, and I think we all benefit from discussing what's sort of out there and what eventually ends up in retail hands. As far as sort of we see the starting point of using derivatives to manufacture returns, the purpose has to be to basically do something that a physical market can't do, a conventional instruments can't do. It has to create a broader universe of investable opportunities. Having said that, it needs to be obviously pretty straightforward. It needs to be easy to understand. It can't be loaded with fees. We're seeing a lot of examples of things that might have started off as a good idea, but that basically very quickly become either too complicated or too expensive for people to use. And it should, I guess, it's been a win-win situation from the point of view that investors have been able to access alternative payoffs that they haven't used in the past. And if structured correctly, it should be done where an institution where the market's allowed to transfer investment risk so that they're not aggregated with one institution, preferably not the institution who's not suited to take on that type of risk. We'll just add this slide to basically give a broad overview of what that universe can be in terms of how to structure a derivative. It can be very simple. We can talk about stocks or stock indices, ASX 200. The payoff can be a very simple, just index-like return, long only. The asset allocation can be fixed. So that's effectively replicating what a passive manager will do. Or it can be a lot more complicated. We can use sort of managed funds or other more exotic assets as underlyings. It can be a CPPI type of payoff, a long short, etc., and the asset allocation can be more dynamic. So just, I guess I'd go through a few examples of using that type of approach. One thing that we're seeing a lot of interest in at the moment is commodities, in particular agricultural commodities. A view being that effectively the extreme growth that we're seeing in many Asian countries has already impacted the food patterns and behavior of a growing middle class. Basically, it takes a kilo of grain to produce a kilo of grain, by definition. And it, on average, it takes about 10 kilos of grain to produce a kilo of meat. So that's why we've seen, obviously, in the press in the last few weeks, the extreme bottleneck that's causing on the supply of grains and so on. So this is just a very simple, agricultural index, a four-year term with a capital guarantee in Aussie dollars. And because it's basically set up, the payoff is essentially a bond and a call option. It gives an 80% participation on the underlying performance with a guarantee at the end. Moving on to another example in equities. Again, a pretty simple underlying ASX 20, so large caps. The payoff is effectively a two-year note with a 95% guarantee. So you investors are seeing some downside there, and using volatility to actually, instead of making the guarantee more expensive, we use volatility to make the guarantee cheaper, rather to improve the actual overall payoff of this, because we've sort of capped the individual shares in the 20 share basket. So the payoff at the end would be 95% plus the performance of the individual shares, plus 10% bonus, which is basically there to compensate for dividends, up to a cap of 60%. So what that means is that to the extent that all shares in the underlying basket perform better than 50% plus the bonus of 10%, then that's where you've sort of capped your performance. And if it all turns to custard tomorrow, then the investor will get 95% of the cash back. And looking at how that has performed compared to the broad equity markets, we have the ASX 200 total return, which obviously has dividends included in it. We have the price return, and then we have an equally weighted ASX 20 price return, and then our two-year derivatives-based note here. So in sort of obviously negative environments, so this is the two-year backtesting prior to the date that you can see on the bottom line there. So basically starting in R2, that would be entering into these type of indices in August 2000. That structure, you know, it's quite obvious, performs pretty well. It even performs well when you have IRRs sort of single digits and even the low teens sort of thing. It's when you get into the extreme levels that we've had in the last few years where the broad market does, you know, 25-30%, that obviously by default this type of structure will not perform that well. So it's you know, an idea, I guess, for people that think that they might still want to be exposed to an equity type of risk, but, you know, happy to forego some upside. And this, I guess, we put in this example, a Himalaya call. That's when you're talking about some of the more exotic things. And this is, again, where it needs to be very straightforward about what it is that we're actually pricing, because this is one of the examples where it's very easy for providers to start adding on fees just because of the complexity. I think a Himalaya call, which is something whereby, say you have four underlyings, can be shares or funds or whatever, the payoff is such that there's an observation date every, you know, say every year. It's a four-year structure, and you have an observation date every year. On each observation date, you take the best performing asset since inception, and you record that performance, and then you take it out of the structure. It's something that you'd use if you are positive about the underlyings, but you're not quite sure about when in time you think that a potential rally might occur. Also, like we said in the bottom there, low volatility, high correlation, high yielding option currency means that you achieve better pricing. So depending on what the underlying is, that may or may not be appropriate. There's one thing out at the moment based on the four golds, so-called, just a theme. It's based on a gold fund, a water fund, an energy fund, so effectively oil, and a clean energy fund, so wind mostly. Where investors might think that, well, those themes are quite attractive, but I'm not sure about when they are going to sort of do well over the next, say, 4 years. So a Himalaya option might be the payoff that might be the most attractive to use then. And this is an asset class that Zach and I touched on in another session. It's effectively longevity, meaning the lifespan of individuals. So it's basically something that mirrors the US life policy market, where there's actually a secondary market for life policies that are traded. It's priced quite attractively at about roughly 12% returns in US dollar terms, so slightly higher in Aussie dollar terms. It works in the way that an insurance company, which obviously sells a life policy to a policyholder, when the policyholder wants to get out of it, rather than just not paying for it and having the potential future benefit expire worthless, they can go back to the insurance company, or they can sell it to another investor in the market. And like I said, on average, based on the life expectancy of individuals, that tends to be priced at about 12% IRR. The problem is that you don't know when a pool of individuals will pass away, so you don't know when you'll actually realize the death benefit in this case. So we can, and that's not necessarily that it's quite appealing to a pension fund, for example, but it's not that appropriate for a retail fund, or a retail investor. So you can easily take that and structure it into a note where you improve a lot of the payoff characteristics of that. So for example, for a savings, so similar to, I guess, a super type of investment, a zero coupon note, we effectively just take the first 7 years of an underlying pool of life policies, and we see when, after 7 years, how many underlying policy holders do we believe, or individuals do we believe are expected to have passed away. And then as long as the actual outcome is not too far away from that expected number, we can then pass on a 12%, so LIRA plus 8% return. In terms of an income product, it would be probably appropriate to have an ongoing coupon that's pretty attractive. So we're guaranteeing then for a seven-year note, we're guaranteeing a LIRA plus 3.5% type of coupon. But that the uncertainty is then about what you receive at the end. As long as people pass away as per expected, it's quite morbid to discuss these things. So Zach assured me that in a room full of actuaries that this is stuff that you guys think about all the time. So, anyways, then you should get effectively a 109%. So that equates to a LIRA plus 4.5% type of return. Obviously very easy to do the same thing with a protected note where you know that the worst you can do is a zero IRR sort of thing. So you get coupons of LIRA plus 2% and you get at worst 59% of your money back, which equates to LIRA plus 0%. So, Zach, do you want to summarize sort of? You might have to, okay, you don't.
So I suppose what we're just trying to get at is that if you are going down the route of launching sort of products, whether they be retail or sort of large superannuation type products with guarantees in them, it's firstly important to understand the full spectrum of risks that you're taking on by offering those guarantees. Normally the first choice approach to people is to investigate, can I manage all those risks in-house? There's no reason why you can't, but as we saw from that table and how it gradually got more complicated, it can be complicated and complex. So then it comes down to, do I have the resources and do I want to expend the resources required to manage that properly when I'm not actually sure how big a part of my overall business that will be? If not, then the concept we're trying to bring up is, instead of then using derivatives to manage the risk, you can either, in the examples I gave, you can either just buy that guarantee from someone else, and yes, they'll be making, well, they'll expect to make profit along the way. Who knows, it'll end up on their, what the markets do to them instead of what the markets do to you. But they already have those systems in place, and they already have that expertise in place. Or, as Matisse then gave a few examples of, instead, if what retail investors are really after is just a different type of risk return profile, then is there a way that you can create that in the assets themselves so that there is no actual ongoing investment risk for you to manage? But noting that there's no point having complexity for complexity's sake. Something's got to sell to retail. It's got to be kept as simple as it can and not loaded up with fees. That's it. So, questions now?
You just ask to identify yourself before you ask the question.
Daniel Levy, thanks very much for the talk. Just around the cost of the guarantees in the managing the risk category, I'm presuming that what you're saying is the cost is going to depend on the volatility. Yes. And when you've illustrated for a 0% guaranteed return, you're saying that the cost of that volatility is 0.4% per annum. Now, I'm also presuming that you can't lock this in up front now, so really that cost is going to depend on what happens in the future with the market volatility. Okay. And so there's actually a cost of unknown volatility for the future. Is that correct sort of summary?
Not in this case. These costs were calculated because in response to the product AXA had launched, a few fund managers who we deal with came to us and said, look, we can't compete with AXA's product because they can only charge such a cheap amount because they're putting their own balance sheet at risk. We as just fund managers can't do that. We don't really have a balance sheet. So they asked us, look, for an AXA-type guarantee, how much would it cost for Deutsche Bank to provide the guarantee? And that's the cost that we came up with. So that is fixed up front. That's 0.42, in that example, 0.42% of the initial investment per year.
So doesn't that mean that Deutsche in this case and AXA in the other example are actually not giving a market price for the volatility they're accepting on their balance sheet, so therefore they're shortchanging their shareholder?
We never shortchange our shareholders.
No.
I think it's worth noting that in a 10-year structure, there's not really a market price for 10-year volatility. You can use options and maybe go out. Well, you can obviously go out to a year, maybe possibly 2 years in Australia. But effectively, someone with a balance sheet like a bank can make a market in what 10-year volatility should be. So from that point of view, it's impossible to know what that market value is because there isn't a market for it. Is that also your
sort of? And have you in the other example where you're talking about products where you pass that risk on to the investors? What's the cost of counterparty default or other catastrophic events that aren't really catered for in the derivatives you're using?
Yeah, that's a very good point, I think, because, and certainly in the last few months, it's been maybe we should move close to this. The cost of counterparty risk should definitely be reflected in that. We've seen, counterparty risk is something that can be offset in the credit default swap market at a price, so that probably has to be incorporated as well if you want to remove that risk. We've seen spreads for pretty solid banks blow up quite dramatically in the last few months. I'd say that the spreads of the one sort of business line brokers blew out a lot, but the spreads for diversified banks, particularly banks that have access to a broader sense, a broader set of sort of funding sources, were a lot more solid. I'm not really here to sort of blow the trumpet about from a Deutsche Bank point of view, but being a broad diversified bank and having fortunately a big solid German depositor base certainly helped us weather through these the last few months, whereas some of the probably more the US clean brokers had a much tougher time. Now it's come back in again because the Fed appears to be stepping up and sort of protecting against that type of risk, but it's certainly over a 10-year horizon, I think it's a risk that needs to be considered.
Thank you.
Mike Barker, thanks, a good presentation. Where I'm operating is more in the advisory space, trying to interpret some of these products either to retail investors or on behalf of retail investors. And it seems to me that there's a million things or an infinite number of things you can create here, but actually explaining them is another matter. And I think, Zach, had a throwaway line, what the retail market wants. I don't think the retail market really knows what it wants, but I think the marketing departments find that some things are easier to sell than others, and those things are generally the things that look fantastic but don't cost very much. So there's a real gap there. I don't know what the answer is. I know I've seen some structured products where I haven't got a clue what the payoff is going to be, let alone what they're worth, because the payoff is defined in terms of a CPPI, which is not transparent, so you don't know what the formula is. You don't know, for instance, one recent product, which I think is about to be launched, says you'll get, after 5 years, you'll get somewhere between 100 and 250% of the gain in the ASX 200 index. And it's using CPPI to get there, but it's very hard to know where you're going to be between 100 and 250, and it's quite a big difference. But I see the retail investor sort of focusing on the 250, and that's great, we might get 250, when in fact is the chances are they're going to be bloody lucky to get more than 120.
That's right, yeah.
So what's the role of the actuarial profession in actually moving further out? I mean, I know you're just manufacturing, this has been a good presentation saying what you can do, But at Lair, there's a huge number of people misinterpreting, putting smokes and mirrors around these things and turning them into things which end up on a gullible public who really haven't got any idea and really don't know what they want. So if you've got any ideas what we as a profession could be doing about it.
Probably nothing too insightful. I, at the risk of contradicting what everyone said sort of this morning, we saw one recently, the product that was launched, which was based on a retail product, which was based on four different, I think, alpha strategies that were supplied by an investment bank. The PDS had, it was about 60 pages, of which one was devoted to the assets and the investment strategy, just one page. And then the only way you could actually, and seriously, it was one bullet point each of a couple of words. It's this strategy, this one, and this one. The only way we could find out more about it was to actually look at an asset consultant who'd reviewed it. And they then expanded that one page into three pages, but it still didn't help much. So, you know, I definitely think that the role to play is, I suppose, you know, if there's, I suppose, a broader education role, it's to, you know, have the discussion that, you know, you aren't just limited to equities and bonds, and you aren't just limited to paying, you know, a certain percent for a guarantee, but also, if you want something different, you're not limited to something you can't understand. Yeah, there is somewhere in the middle.
Where do you think ASIC should stand in all this? At the moment, ASIC's saying, well, it's not our job to build up a product that I've seen, one product where they came back with two pages of comments on what they thought was inappropriate in the PDS.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not going to... Yeah. Anyone else think where ASIC should stand?
I think Alec Holley this morning had some good points about the independence of advisors, because certainly from where we're coming from, we're a manufacturer of returns, but we don't have a retail distribution force. So we can't really sort of, we can sell to private banks, say, or to insurance companies, to pension funds and asset managers and so on. But it's just the example that Zach brought up there, I was just flabbergasted to see how something as opaque as that could actually be turned into an investable mum and dad type of structure. There are so many good sort of return streams out there, and this one, I have no idea where it's a good one or not, because I had three bullet points to, and then I had 59 pages about something else in the PDS. Mm-hmm. So I think one, obviously that puts a lot of emphasis on the role of the asset consultant. And I'm not, obviously, it's you have retail, middle market, and institutional asset consultants, and I think at all those levels there is definitely a need for some degree of independence of those asset consultants, and whether you need a regulator to come in and enforce that or not, I don't know.
I believe most of the research houses are way behind in terms of their ability to actually get these sort of things. And let's face it, if anyone who's good at this sort of stuff can earn probably three times as much working for Deutsche than they would working for a research house. So why would they be working at a research house trying to analyse these products if research houses can't afford to pay that much?
I don't work in a research house.
His
wife does.
That's right.
It's a fair point. I don't necessarily think that means they should just throw their hands up in the air and ignore them, though. You know, just because you might not be able to, you don't have the resource. I don't think it's a matter of intelligence. It's just a matter of having the time to devote to that small section of the market when they're actually trying to cover the whole thing.
Okay, anyone else?
Andrew Swain. Just looking at the hedging instruments there and the scale you had of the continuum, how much of a drop-off is there between the ability to use, say, the underlying stock futures swaps, and then you go down into, say, the options, and so you certainly go from exchange-traded markets, which are fairly transparent, into a fairly murky world where you've really it's incredibly difficult to understand how things are priced. And I guess that's sort of one observation versus is that potentially one of the reasons why people only get that far and decide, hey, we're not going to worry about gamma and vega because our overriding policy is we don't deal in these things. So they're kind of half caught with their pants down because they think they've got it covered but don't really understand end-to-end risk. Is that...
A fair point. And like in all, most aspects of finance, there's this a never-ending evolution of sort of new products coming out and so on. And as these products get embraced by different, maybe by hedge funds first and then by institutional investors and so on, they become more and more commoditized and hence cheaper. So something like a variance swap was highly exotic a few years ago. And it's also variance swap effectively just a way to trade pure volatility. So if I buy variance at, volatility at 23% and realize volatility of whatever ASX 200 was 25, then I've sort of made two volatility points. So it's a way to trade volatility, which options don't do because they're path dependent and all kinds of things. It's something that, it's an instrument that was highly exotic only a few years ago, 2 or 3 years ago. Now it's as plain vanilla as anything. It's a very competitive market, priced very tightly and so on. So it's similar with options on variance. No one's even heard of it a year ago, whereas it's starting to come in. Now. It's still quite expensive, but give it another year or two. I think that that's also going to be priced competitively such that it opens up the user base much more than what it is. I think that's part of it. It's sort of a bit of sort of build it and they will come, and then it's too expensive and then it takes a little while, and then as more and more people embrace it, it becomes cheap enough to use.
Bill's probably about to go. Maybe time for one quick question. If otherwise, please join me in thanking Zach. Oh, sorry. Yep.
It's Edmund New. I just asked a simple question from you on the example that you gave on the 10-year maturity. If you're allowing for the costs of the derivatives and so on, how does the risk return profile bring it back to, in comparison to, say, a capital stable option? Because you've got a 50-50 and the capital stable is about 30-70, so your derivatives actually bringing a bit more cash back and so on.
A capital stable option with a guarantee or without a guarantee?
Without a guarantee.
They're just different things here. I mean, the asset mix here is almost a capital stable asset mix. It's just how much does it cost to guarantee it won't go backwards. A capital stable option shouldn't go backwards, but it might. Yeah, and I mean... That's a good question. I mean, if it'd be interesting to see if anyone hears from AXA, how their sales are going so far, because by the time you add on investment management fees and admin fees, you're looking at sort of 3-4% a year for a guarantee. You think over the long term, am I just better off taking my chances? I think this is where one hole, I'll just finish up very quickly, one that actuaries do fall into a lot, is to say, oh, over thousands of scenarios, there's no way that would be better off. But we only invest over one scenario. Mm-hmm. So it really just depends whether you're willing to run the risk that it's not your scenario, or that your scenario isn't one of the ones where this would have been better.
Okay, I think we're probably out of time. I'm sure Zach and Matthias would be happy to answer other questions another time. But please join me in thanking Zach and Matthias.